Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. Damian Wright, appearing on behalf of the appellants Eric and Destiny Vogler. This is a case that arises from a construction contract for a residential home. The Voglers entered into a construction contract with Shelton Brothers Construction, who is one of the appellees. The other appellees are subcontractors that Shelton subcontracted with for certain portions of the work. There is a preliminary issue in this case that had to be resolved by the trial court as to the nature of the contract, whether it was fixed price or a cost plus contract. The interesting thing about this case is that I think that whichever path you go down, you end up with the same result as far as the conclusion that Shelton breached the contract, but the analysis is slightly different. And I'll start with the analysis under the cost plus contract, because that was what the trial court concluded, that this was a cost plus contract. And my clients disagree with that, but if we assume for the sake of argument that it was a cost plus contract, then you have to follow an analysis that determines what the contractor's duties are under a cost plus contract. And the trial court, we would submit, error in not following out that analysis of what a contractor's duties are under the cost plus contract.
And when you say duties, are you saying duties by reference to the contract or some general jurisprudential duties?
Your Honor, I believe that they are implied by law. And this court has never squarely resolved that issue, and quite frankly, there's not a lot of case law that I could find in the national jurisprudence. But I did cite two cases in my brief that I believe are very much on point. One of them, I believe, was from Maryland. One of them was from Tennessee. I believe their analysis is cogent. It's well-reasoned. I believe it's, frankly, I believe it's a policy that it almost has to be implied in cost-plus contracts.
What duties would you have this court imply by law?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically in this case, the two that were really important is that, one, the contractor under a cost-plus contract should have to provide an accounting of what its actual costs are. And in some of the secondary authorities that I cited, they say that estimates are not sufficient. The contractor has to account with what its actual costs are, and then it charges a markup. So they got to provide an accounting to the owner of what the costs are. Secondarily, and this also comes from one of the treatise secondary authorities, I think that they have a general obligation to inform the homeowner as the construction is progressing as to where the budget stands. And if they foresee that there may be cost overruns associated with the project, they need to notify the homeowner. Hey, this element of framing is coming in higher than I anticipated.
How can there be a cost overrun in a cost-plus contract?
Well, that's the interesting thing about this contract and the way that in cost-plus contracts in general is that in this contract, there's this $282,000 number that's in the contract. It actually says it's an agreed-upon price. And I will tell you, for residential homeowners, it's in my experience, it's unusual that a residential homeowner would want to use a cost-plus contract. Residential homeowners, they want to build a house. They want to know what it's going to cost them. So the very finding that this was cost plus, in my view, was odd and against the weight of the evidence. But that's what's odd, is that the homeowners, in this case the Voglers, had a very clear idea. They thought that they were on target for $282,000. Whether that's fixed price or whether that's an estimate that the contractor had given them as a basis for entering into the contract, they had in their heads, and rightfully so, that this project was going to cost $282,000. If it's a cost-plus contract, then Shelton, as the costs are escalating, the Vogler saw this approaching $260,000 and still having some way to go before this is going to be completed, they started questioning, where are we at? Where is the budget? And also they questioned, there was a $28,000 payment that they had initially put forward that had never been accounted for. There were no invoices, no explanation as to where that went. And so their question was, where are we at? And I think it has to be the duty of the contractor to say...
Let me go back to those duties, if you will. So are you saying, and I'm not quite clear on your previous answer, that there is a duty implied by law to inform the owners from time to time where the project stands in terms of cost? Is that what you're saying, regardless of the language of the contract?
Yes.
Okay. And when you refer to accounting, is that a periodic accounting, or is that once you get to litigating, there needs to be a formal accounting or something of that nature?
I would say it certainly applies upon request. If the homeowner says, what are the bills, they have to be able to see them.
Okay. So these items that you would seek us to employ in the Maryland and the Tennessee cases, those were terms of the contract. So that's not this case, kind of, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so you're liking the secondary authorities better.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And I do believe, Your Honor, that it would be very difficult for me to fathom that you could have a cost-plus contract where the contractor doesn't have to account for its actual expenses and where the contractor doesn't have to inform the homeowner of what the project expenses are, especially when they're asking for it. The trial court, I believe, got focused in on the issue of whether this was cost plus or fixed price. But from the Vogler's perspective, whether it was cost plus or fixed price, they always thought that it was 282. And they started questioning when the expenses started rising. So even if Shelton thought it was cost plus, then the response to the Vogler should have been, well, we're on a cost plus contract. Here's where we're at. Here's the bills. Here's what you've spent to date. Here's what I think it's going to be to get us through completion. Because that's what the Voglers wanted to know. And that's what any homeowner would want to know. You're not just writing checks without some end in sight as to how are we going to get to the end of this tunnel.
What would be, in terms of evidentiary reference to the record, what would be your best piece of evidence or pieces that the Voglers always thought this was 282, no more, no less?
Your Honor, I quoted Eric Vogler's statements in the brief where he said, how am I supposed to know where we're at? And Your Honor, this was interesting at trial. At the beginning of the trial, Shelton's position seemed to be, well, there were all these extras that the Voglers kept asking for, and that's why the costs were escalating. I cross-examined Mr. Shelton as to these. What are these? What are these amounts? To this day, I still have no idea. Could not name one amount of this is an extra and here's how much it costs. We still don't know what they are. Once I started cross-examining...
So Mr. Shelton testified, did he not, that the Voglers were living in a trailer approximate to the job.
Correct.
Is that right?
For part of it, yes, they were.
For part of it, is that right? And that the general's not always on the job. Not surprising. That's okay.
Well, yes. That was one of the issues that
or
my people
maybe
had.
That's an issue that he wasn't attentive.
Somebody.
Okay. But that is testimony. Is this correct? Would I come take a look at the end of the day and the Voglers had suggested changes or ordered changes or stuff to that effect?
This is the issue.
Whether or not it's true, whether or not it's to be believed, isn't there testimony to that effect?
Yes. And so my question is, fine, tell me those changes. Tell me what they cost.
I see.
Where is it? And I went round and round with Mr. Shelton about, if you proposed 282 for your contract, what was your base that you used to get that number at that you thought the original contract was? And then whether they were change orders, whether they were extras ordered by the Vogler, whatever it was, at the end of this, when you're adding up your numbers, how do we get from A to B? Any contractor should be able to do that. If it's fixed price, you do it through change orders. You can see the start of the contract, change order, change order, change order. Here's the end of the contract. If it's cost plus, I can't fathom how you could work without having your initial estimate or something that you're preparing for the homeowners of here's what I'm going to build you. And if there are changes along the way that are causing the cost to escalate, you should be able to account to the homeowner and say, well, we had these fixtures, lighting fixtures, initially bid out. That's what you wanted. By the end of the project, you select the A, B, C, and D. That's where your extra costs are at. But my caveat to that would be that when a homeowner says, well, I want different fixtures, it has to be the contractor's responsibility to say, we can do the extra fixtures. This is going to cost you more.
Did you file a cross-claim that would have asked for an accounting? Or is that even a relevant question, the way you're using accounting for this argument?
Well, we filed a counterclaim for the overages under the theory that it was fixed price and that the contract price was $282 plus some change orders, which my people agree there were some change orders. We just don't know what the number is because we've never been provided with them, but $282. And then we ultimately had to cover by hiring a subsequent contractor to perform remedial work. whatever the differences we're entitled to. So we didn't request an accounting because, quite frankly, we never believed that this was a cost-plus contract.
I see. Thank you.
I see that I'm about out of time unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nelson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Justice of the Supreme Court. My name is Timothy Nelson, and I'm here for 3 minutes, Mr. Chief Justice, to talk about Shelton Brothers Construction. There are a couple of items that I think that are important to note when you look at the record in this case. Shelton Brothers was the general contractor for Eric and Destiny Vogler to rebuild a residence that was damaged by fire. Everyone agrees to that. Everyone agrees that there was a written contract for this. The problem we have is that when the project began, a number of changes were done inside of the contract. And perhaps even a greater problem for the Voglers are the Voglers decided to hire outside contractors to come in and work on the job because they wanted this done this way. They added space to the house. They did all of these things. And yet they expected Shelton Brothers to pay those costs out of the 282.
When you referred to added space, how did that come about, according to the record? Was that at Vogler's request?
Or at Vogler's request,
was that done on the basis of some technical proposal?
Sorry for interrupting, Your Honor.
Sure.
The Voglers moved a wall out 2 feet. The record shows that they did it at their request because they wanted a larger kitchen. So we had to do complete new footings and all of those things inside of it. The footings in the old house were there.
I beg your pardon, it was not at the instance of a mechanical engineer type?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That I believe is in there. I don't think we even have to get to this point, frankly, Your Honors, because the contract is very clear that payments had to be made within 10 days. And on February 18, 2016, the second draw was requested. So on February 28, 2016, the contract was done. The contract expired on that day. It's true that the general contractor and the subcontractors continued to work for about 3 months while Voglers had this excuse for non-payment or that excuse for non-payment. But the fact is that the contract itself was expired at that time. The other thing that I want to...
Expired. Breached?
Breached. I'm sorry, Your Honor, breached.
Okay. So the contract didn't cease to exist. It was just breached.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right.
The other items that I wanted to make sure that I cover is that the standard review for this court we believe to be clearly erroneous, and Shelton asks the court to give deference to the trial court as it heard the witnesses and obviously believed one side and disbelieved the other.
So are you arguing that we apply the law standard of review or the equity standard? This was a foreclosure, wasn't it?
This was a foreclosure, yes,
Your Honor. Doesn't that sound inequity?
It does.
And so even though it's de novo, but we do give consideration to the fact that the trial court saw and heard.
The trial court not only heard the evidence, but did a really extensive order where he explained what he believed and what the trial court did not believe.
When the contract provides, this contract is to be executed as a cost-plus contract, where all costs for the project will be presented to the homeowners and the builder's fees, and then they go on to the percentages. What do you understand all costs for the project will be presented to the homeowners to mean? Is that a periodic accounting as appellant seeks?
We believe that the accounting was done periodically by reason of emails sent to the homeowners that are all included inside of the record as well, with copies of this and this and this. We did not present any for contractors that were hired outside of the contract by the Voglers directly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lures, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice, my name is Jim Lures. I represent Tanner Goes, one of the appellees in this particular case. And I'll try to do my argument in 3 minutes as well. There was a couple things brought up against Mr. Goes that we believe have nothing to do with whether it's a fixed cost or cost plus. Mr. Goes was one of the subcontractors in this case. And as far as the brief was concerned, although it wasn't brought up either in evidence or argument, was that Voglers were somehow protected parties with zero lien liability. Their argument being that based upon some mathematical errors and some reductions that they came up with, that the final prime contract cost was less than $282,000 or something like $260,000, and that by January or February or March, they had paid more than that, and therefore their lien liability was zero. When you look back at Section 52.127.1, which defines a prime contract as a real estate improvement contract between an owner and a general, and then 52.127.2 defines the contract price to include extras and changes made to the original contract, it's our argument, Your Honors, that the prime contract is 282 plus the changes which the Voglers admitted they made, including shakes and scallops and new windows or different windows and the moving of the wall, etc., of at least $15,000 on top of that, which makes the contract price actually $297,000, if you can follow that. And then by January 1st, when they quit paying, they had only paid $203,000, which is verified not only by their testimony, but by also Exhibit 48. So if you subtract that 297 minus the 203, the difference is the lien liability under 52.136, and that is something like $94,000. Our argument, obviously, is when they quit paying on a monthly basis, which was actually they didn't pay January, they didn't pay February, March, or April, they breached the contract. And consequently, at that point in time, when they went out and hired additional subs, that shouldn't be added to their contract price to justify some sort of claim that they have no lien liability. In fact, even if we give them benefit of the doubt that they paid through, as to what they paid as of May 1st, 2016, which they then claim they sent the letter demanding some sort of accounting or whatever, they had still only paid $260,000, which under my calculation of the 297 still leaves $37,000 in lien liability. It should be noted that the 52.136.5 defines protected party lien liability as a prime contact less payments properly made under the contract. So they're going out and hiring other subs on their own and not paying the general or his subs shouldn't be added to that contract price and somehow reduce their lien liability.
Can I just clarify something, because yes, the cases were consolidated, that you're referring primarily to our case S18-1201, which is Goes versus Vogler, which is proceeding on the lien basis.
We tried them together, obviously.
There's an outcome that merges some concepts, but that was your initial pleading.
That was my initial pleading,
okay.
Yes.
On behalf of Goes. Okay.
On behalf of Goes, yes. And ultimately, the court sustained the foreclosure of Mr. Goes' lien. The second argument the Voglers made against the Voglers was that the evidence didn't support their lien foreclosure and that the most they were entitled was $14,000. Under the evidence, there was no objection to the lien, there was no objection to the testimony of Shelton or Goes that the work was done, properly billed, and that they hadn't paid all of it, and there was no testimony by Voglers that they had overpaid Goes for the work. Exhibit 54 was the invoice. It shows $27,578. Exhibit 41 was Goes' lien. It shows $27,578, which was consistent with Exhibit 48, which, although if you look at Exhibit 48, it's got entries showing exactly what was billed, exactly what was paid, with leaving a total of unpaid of $28,479. I don't think there's anything improper about filing a lien for less than what was totally owned, and that's what was done in this case. And there are arguments that somehow there was a missing invoice or something else is simply red herring. The additional $9,000 that they claim in the evidence that they weren't shown was part of Exhibit 54, which is invoices dated February 2nd of Mr. Goes, and it's broke down in Exhibit 35, which was an email from Shelton to Vogler explaining precisely what was done with that additional $9,000. To that extent, we ask you to affirm the district court order completely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Byrd, good morning to you.
Morning. Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to start out just by stating that I concur and I join in the arguments that have been made up to this point by Mr. Nelson and Lures. I would like to add an argument as to an unjust enrichment matter. Even if this court were to find that the contract were a fixed price contract, there then remains the issue of unjust enrichment. Because the appellant, in our case, for the appellee, Franklin Drywall, received over $15,000 worth of drywall materials and installation services, which were in place at the time of trial. And the appellant has been benefiting from the work that the appellees have done since that time. The amount remains completely unpaid as we stand here today, and thereby unjustly enriching the appellant to the detriment of the appellees, who are entitled to complete restitution, as was correctly held by the trial court. Similarly, the appellant has also been benefiting from unjust enrichment as it pertains to the general contractor and other subcontractors who provided materials and services on this project as well and has not yet been paid.
Does unjust enrichment apply where there's an express contract?
I believe that there is because the contract has been breached. The performance by our client had been completed on that end, and the payment has not been yet made, and so they are being unjustly enriched by holding on to all the materials and the services that were provided to them and obtaining the benefit of the contract which they've received to date. And so my position is that it would be wholly unjust if the appellant were not required to fully compensate each and every contractor who provided the materials and services that were requested by the appellant, including the contract changes that were made by their change orders. And quickly, in conclusion, the trial court correctly held that the contract in dispute in the matter was a cost-plus contract, that the appellant breached the contract, and that the appellees, as well as all of the other subcontractors which weren't paid, are entitled to a judgment in the entire amount of materials and service provided. If the court disagrees with the trial court that this was a cost-plus contract, my position is the appellees would still be entitled to restitution due to unjust enrichment because of the appellant's breach of the contract. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Abdul F. Van. I am recused from this matter. Justice Miller Lerman will preside on this case as well as the last case of the day, which is State versus Jackie Harris, and I am recused from that matter too, and Justice Frydenberg is recused from that matter. But the court will be joined by Chief Judge Moore again and Judge Welch for that case. Now, give me a moment to get out of the courtroom, and as I said, Justice Miller-Lerman will preside. Thank you very much.